Blog Talk Radio.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Cure Panel Talk Show on Myeloma. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at the Cure Panel Cure Talk, joining you from India, and I welcome all of you this evening to a discussion on multiple myeloma. This is our first show on myeloma in the new year and the 44th episode of the Cure Panel Talk Show. Going forward, we have some interesting shows featuring eminent experts lined up for you this year. Please visit curepanel.carefree.net for more information on our upcoming shows, or you can always mail me, priya@trilex.com. Our previous show on myeloma had Dr. Fritz Van Rie of UAMS Little Rock talk about total therapy in myeloma. And today, we are discussing multiple myeloma with the Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation, or the MMRF. Towards the end of last year, 2013, MMRF rolled out three important cancer research initiatives: big data and genomic sequencing, open access by sharing research data, and empowering patients to find clinical trials that are best for them. And trying to understand how MMRF hopes to achieve this and help the myeloma community is the focus of today's discussion. My co-host for the day is Pat Killingsworth, noted myeloma blogger, advocate, and author. Supporting Pat on the panel are Gary Peterson, editor of MyelomaSurvival.com, patient advocate, Cynthia Schmilewski, Matt Goldman, and Lissy Smith. I welcome all of you to the show today. With that, I will hand over to Pat, who will introduce us to our experts of the day and begin with the discussion. Pat, you're live on air.
Thank you, Priya, and wow, what a wonderful panel we have joining me this evening, questioning Gary, Cindy, Matt, and Lizzie. Doesn't get any better than that. And what a great guest we have this evening. Anne with the MMRF is joining us. Anne, are you there?
I'm here.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. Anytime you're a myeloma survivor and you can say you're great, that's a pretty good day, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely.
Anne, could you just give us a little background about yourself and what you do at the MMRF, and then we can get into the real discussion about all of the important projects that the group is doing.
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, thank you, Priya, and the rest of the CureTalk team. It was an honor to speak last year, and certainly we're very grateful for the opportunity to kick off or to be part of this in the new year as well. And thank you, Pat, for that those words as well. I am Vice President of Marketing at the MMRF. I've been there almost 12 years. In that time, I've worn many different hats, but primarily I'm responsible for marketing and communications around the MMRF, as well as all of our educational initiatives, both for patients and caregivers and for healthcare professionals. Pat, do you want me to go directly into comments about the foundation as well? Or?
Sure, unless you want me to translate, and for our listeners, that basically means that that Ann does the heavy lifting over there. I mean, you got to admit, you do a lot that goes far beyond the job description you just read. But I would think of you as indispensable, and I'm sure your teammates feel that way too.
Thank you, Pat. No, it's honestly a team effort, and I was grateful for the opportunity to join the MMRF 12 years ago, because I could see, even at that time, how the field was about to, how the disease was about to change. I coincidentally had a friend who worked at Millennium, and so I knew, even prior to coming to the MMRF, I knew about Velcade and the potential for that to completely transform this disease that had had, prior to that, you know, not so much hope. And, you know, the opportunity to work side by side with Kathy Giusti, who, you know, for Pat, I know, you know, you've met her, and for those on the phone who know her, you know, she's a driven individual, and coupled with, you know, her diagnosis of multiple myeloma, that drive and that urgency, it was contagious. And I, you know, wanted to be a part of this and could see, you know, what was happening in the field and the company, the serendipity with Velcade and thalidomide and the field really starting to come together, the companies getting behind this, the doctors, and then, you know, us trying to pull everyone, you know, all together. It was really motivating back then, and, you know, 12 years later, wow, the field has just changed so dramatically, and, you know, the outcomes for patient experience today is vastly, vastly different. You know, I don't know if there's if people like Jack Aiello or others are on the call, but certainly anyone who was around, you know, 10, 12 years ago, it was a very different place. So, you know, I'll kind of use that as a segue, you know, to speak a little bit about what we're doing. You know, Pat, you gave kind of the challenge or the statement that, you know, we you think we could do a better job of really letting the patient community know about what we do. And I think part of the challenge is we're a small team, about 30, 35 people based in Connecticut, and we don't have people across, we don't have chapters, we don't have people across the region. And we're all very, I'd say almost, you know, in a way nerdy, very focused and excited by what's going on in myeloma research and really doing everything that we possibly can to accelerate new treatments for patients, because we've seen the progress that the entire community has made working together in the last 10 or 12 years, but we see you know, there are still challenges ahead. It's not cured. Not every patient is living 10, 15 or more years. How can we make sure that, you know, we're bringing up the survival of every single patient? And, you know, our activities span funding basic research. So we funded 150 centers worldwide. So anyone seen at a major academic center here, Canada, Europe, we've probably provided funding there. We've done, and I know there's some questions around this, so we can discuss it in a little more detail, a lot in the field of genomics. Myeloma is a very heterogeneous disease, meaning I'm sure everyone could see it, talking patients to patients, how everyone seems to have different symptoms and response to treatment. And that goes down to the molecular level. It's not just kind of seen on the surface, but your disease really does differ from patient to patient. So how do we better understand that so that we can get the right treatments, the right combinations to treatment to patients as quickly as possible? And then through our clinical network, we're working to accelerate early clinical trials. And then on the education side, enrolling those trials and helping to educate the community, both patients and providers, about the treatments that are available. So our research consortium is 16 centers, and we've opened, since we launched in 2006, 49 different trials with 24 different agents. And what we're really proud of is not only the fact that Kyprolis and Pomalyst, some of those early trials, the trials that resulted in the FDA approval of those drugs, were run through our clinical network. So, you know, we worked closely with the companies back before Onyx had carfilzomib, when it was back with Proteolix, worked with Proteolix in the very early days to, you know, come up with a plan to move that drug forward quickly. And certainly we've had a longstanding relationship with Celgene dating back to thalidomide. And, you know, in addition to those two getting FDA approval, about 90% of those, 80 to 90% of those drugs that we're supporting in clinical trials are still being studied. So, you know, you may hear about how risky drug development is, how many new drugs fail. We work so closely with our investigators, you know, really some of the best in the world, to pick the best portfolio, to pick those treatments that are most likely to benefit patients. And we're very proud of that, because it leads to a certain amount of efficiency, so that for the most part, you know, you see an MMRC trial, you know it's been vetted by not only our internal team, but some of the leading investigators in the world. We've also shown that our trials open and close faster than some of the published benchmarks, really, you know, underscoring our commitment to speed. We can talk, perhaps this will come up a little bit in some of the questions, but I did see that some folks had questions about, you know, what's coming down the pike. And, you know, we're focused on new and better, bringing forward new and better versions of, you know, the standard classes, proteasome inhibitors and IMiDs. There are, or as some of you may know, there are oral versions of proteasome inhibitors. Millennium has one that's in phase three that, you know, in the next couple of years could be widely available, which, you know, would mean no weekly trips to the cancer center. You could have an all-oral, potentially all-oral regimen. And Onyx has one that's a little bit earlier in development as well. And then, you know, when you look at the new classes, there are a ton of new classes. You know, what I think we're excited about, what I think a lot of patients, doctors are excited about, are some of these antibodies. And elotuzumab, which, you know, is in phase three trials, again, could be available in a couple of years, is the first one coming. And then when you look earlier, there's daratumumab, an anti-CD38 antibody. And then Sanofi also has an anti-CD38 antibody called SAR-65984. Just remember SAR. Hopefully these will get better names soon. But, you know, what's exciting about both of these is they've shown to work on their own, which is very unusual in this disease. And ultimately they'll be combined with other treatments, and it remains to be seen what, you know, what combinations will work best. But the fact that they can work alone in patients who have failed, you know, Velcade and Revlimid and perhaps even Kyprolis and Pomalyst is hugely exciting for us. And, you know, we're, we've actively partnered with Sanofi and then, you know, doing all that we can on daratumumab as well, which is more in the, awareness and enrollment part of trial conduct, but, you know, potentially looking at bringing that into the consortium in the future as well. We open every year between about 6 and 8 trials. We will have, you know, some involving antibodies and then brand new classes as well. And some of the ones that we're excited about, you may have read about ibrutinib, which is a BTK inhibitor, and that's oral. So anytime we can bring an oral agent, certainly effectiveness is most important, but anytime there's an oral agent, you know, we get particularly excited about that. We're also looking at doing some trials in very specific patient populations. So, you know, for example, patients who have deletion of chromosome 17p, those patients, you know, are at higher risk for disease progression. So we're looking at some very specific combinations, both in newly diagnosed patients as well as those who are relapsed and refractory. In parallel to all of these efforts, we are continuing to characterize the disease at a genomic level. And that goes back to my earlier point that the disease is highly heterogeneous. We're finding out even just 2 weeks ago a publication from a genomics initiative that we started back in 2005 where at the time, we were pioneering in this effort. There were discussions at the NIH to start to profile at a very deep level other cancers, but myeloma was not even discussed. So we thought, you know what, we're just going to take this on, emulate what's being done in these other cancers, but, you know, not rely on NCI, build our own collaboration to move this forward. And so technology changed dramatically. The profiling that we were looking at back then, you know, is again, very, very different from the whole genome sequencing that's possible today. And just 2 weeks ago in Cancer Cell, we published on 203 samples, and it was building on an original 38 that was published back in 2011. And in a lot of the same findings were confirmed, But the one thing that was different, and I was re-looking at the publication today in preparation for the call, and the authors point out it's the heterogeneity within the individual. So an individual patient had on average 4 or 5 different types of myeloma cells. So, it's clear that for the vast majority of patients, a single drug is not going to do it. 2 drugs might not do it. So how do you figure out, what the right combination are? And I did see some postings about people saying, well, this heterogeneity appears later in the disease. What this confirmed is that's not true. Of the 203 samples, 100 were patients who had never received any treatment. So you're looking at, the disease being very complicated, even at diagnosis. It changes over time, but what tends to happen is certain of the myeloma clones, if you will, are controlled, and then, by certain therapies, but then others crop up. And it's not just the combination of treatments at any one time, but what does the sequence look like? And I hope
I was going to say, Anne, let me jump in here so you can take a breath. And, there are multiple hour tangents we could go off on here, I think. Two things jump out at me. The first is that, they talk about messaging in politics, and it's very clear. It should be clear to anyone listening that the MMRF is involved in a wide array of very technical and diverse types of programs, all designed to help promote research and help us as patients. And, the message, I think it's lost. We've talked about this. The message gets lost because it's complicated stuff, and it doesn't fit a soundbite. You hear about this in politics all the time. So I'm not asking so much for your for you to comment on that. That's just an observation that I think should be clear after listening to you talk about all of these complex, different types of things. And the second thing is, this has got to be expensive. you have physicians and researchers on staff, do you not?
We do. Well, yeah, so we have 2 PhDs right now, and we are in the process of trying to hire a replacement for our chief medical officer, so an oncologist. And that's the board, our board of directors is they're tough, and they feel, rightly so, that, we need, an oncologist on staff as well.
Sure. So what could you just tell me, and then let's get to the panel. Could you just tell me how much money was raised and or donated to the MMRF in 2013? What was your budget?
So we haven't. We're not completely through the audit process because we just closed the end of December, but in the high.
Oh, and your fiscal year may be different than the calendar year. What's your
same.
Fiscal year?
They're consistent. We're just in the process of. I think the books are officially closed, but in the high 20s. So, close to $30 million.
Okay. So close to $30 million. That's a lot of money.
It is.
And it's not enough.
It's not easy. The one thing, if I can have 2 more minutes before we go to the panel, and this is why I said we're nerdy. I could talk about what we do in myeloma and myeloma research for hours and hours and hours. What we saw in genomics, the genomics initiative, what we did was we took samples from our MMRC site. So if there are folks on the phone who are seen at one of our 16 centers and have been seen, were seen 4 or 6 years ago, you may have had samples that weren't involved in this. But it was a snapshot in time. So we learned that to really understand this disease at its deepest level, we needed to follow patients over time. So the COMPASS study that some of you may have heard about will follow 1,000 patients from diagnosis prior to any treatment and then do this sequencing work prior to treatment at best response and then at each relapse so that we can see with many, many more patients and, you know, not only understand within an individual patient but start to kind of group patients into these different what we call subtypes and come up with hypotheses for what treatments could be best for them. And what's really neat about COMPASS is that all of the data goes into the public domain. So, you know, typically what happens in research, and this is not unique to myeloma or cancer, this is across the board, you know, researchers hold on to data, companies hold on to data. And once it's published, you know, it's out there, but it can take years. And, you know, with our commitment to speed, we saw that as a barrier to making progress in the disease. And, I mean, I have to recognize so many of the partners. We have, you know, 75 sites worldwide now. We have 4 different pharmaceutical companies backing us. There can be no IP coming from this. And all of the data goes into the public domain. And it's exciting because that means we can, you know, get researchers from myeloma, from outside myeloma, maybe from completely different fields looking at this data. And, you know, what we're doing this year, because we now have, in 2013, we had 200 patients sequenced. So we're creating this critical mass of data and coming up with hypotheses that will be moved into our clinical trials. So that's, you know, that's going to be a big focus. Last year was very much, okay, let's get COMPASS really rolling. And we're completing enrollment this year. Let's get the gateways, and we can talk about the community gateway during the panel, but the researcher gateway, which has all the COMPASS data, and then the gateway for patients, let's get those up and running and come back, and this year, 2014, focus on analyzing that data and starting clinical trials. So I'll stop there.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Fascinating. Gary, are you with us?
Sure am. Pat, how you doing?
All right. Take her away.
Okay, will do. You know, one of the things, and it was really something that came up during your, you know, during your discussion, and that was the funding for multiple myeloma. And, yeah, you think $30 million, that seems like a lot of money. However, the National Cancer Institute has a budget of $5 billion, of which I think the top 10 on their list doesn't even include myeloma.
No.
And the funding for that, the 10th one, is $18 million. And so we must be down there someplace in the single digits in millions. So without the funding from the MMRF, my assessment is there would be much less done in our disease than, and for that, I'll say that it's great that you guys are showing me the money.
Yeah, and you know, the pharmaceutical companies are investing a lot, like much more than NCI in this disease. So certainly, you know, developing a drug is not cheap. The overall estimate is $1 billion. I think, you know, in a small disease like myeloma, you're not, you know, it's not like cardiovascular disease where you have thousands of patients. But suffice to say, it's still in the hundreds of millions of dollars. So if you think about that and then think about, you know, our $30 million, it's kind of a drop in the bucket. But it's expensive to develop drugs. And what we're hearing now is that as we start to break the disease down, so myeloma is not one disease, it's, you know, 8 or 10 different diseases, some of the companies are saying, wait a minute, there wasn't a very big market before, and, you know, there are all these really great drugs. I'm not going to pay for a trial. We're not going to pay for a trial in this small population by ourselves. So more and more we're hearing from companies, and these are, you know, global you know, multi-billion-dollar companies saying, you know what, you're going to help us pay for the trial. So, you know, we really do need, if we're going to get this done and get these more, you know, tailored therapies moving forward, we absolutely need to be able to raise the money to pay for those trials.
Another, you know, one other thing, obviously, is money and focus, and you guys seem to provide, you know, an excellent focus on those that have the greatest possibility. But one of the things that I've read is that only 3% of the population participate in clinical trials, and of the myeloma population, and as a result, you know, we're really limited by that resource as well, not just the money, but also in finding people to be part of clinical trials. So have you found that to be an issue? And if so, what kinds of things are you doing to expand a participation in clinical trials?
So, you know, that's a fantastic question. And you know, a lot of the phase three trials, you know, for myeloma are largely enrolled outside of the U.S. because the companies can't enroll enough U.S. patients quickly enough. You know, we've done, you know, some educational programs. We have, you know, related to CureTalk, a searchable database of trials where, you know, you can click and literally connect right to the center if you think you might be eligible. You know, through our consortium, some of the sites refer, you know, 50% of their patients to trials. But I think what it comes down to is, and this is a problem that was true 10 years, or the challenge, I shouldn't say problem, challenge 10 years ago, is that, you know, if your doctor doesn't suggest it to you or kind of back your decision, it's a difficult for patients to push that. And, you know, what we are trying to do is help patients understand, be more proactive in telling patients about trials specifically for them. So through our community gateway, which is, you know, kind of the companion to the gateway that has the COMPASS data, we're asking patients to share information about themselves so that we can connect them with other patients who may, you know, it could be as simple as someone who's your age, someone who, you know, lives in your area, or it could be someone who, you know, shares the same molecular profile. Or and so not only would you be matched to someone, you could be matched to groups, and we have expert-led interest groups. And then the next phase, which is coming, you know, call it by the end of first quarter, telling patients about trials that are right for them, and then, you know, potentially following up with someone from a nurse from our call center to say, hey, you know, it looks like you could qualify for these trials. Do you want me to place a call to the center? Even I'm, you know, learning about more and more about barriers that exist. And I think some patients also may be under the impression that, you know, their center, especially if they're seen at a main center, has all the trials. And the truth is, a lot of centers, you know, the management at some of these cancer centers is pretty strict to say, you know what, don't take on more trials than you can enroll. So they won't take on competing trials. Companies will say to them, you know what, you already have a trial looking at a competitor of ours. You know, we're not even going to approach you for this trial. So it's important for patients to know to look beyond their center, because their center doesn't have everything. And we're trying to make it as easy as possible through the gateway to let patients know, reach out to patients and say, hey, you know, maybe you should consider this specific clinical trial based on your profile.
I wonder sometimes, you know, having talked to a number of people, that, you know, like perhaps, I don't know, 80%, I don't know what the number is, go to local oncologists or local clinics, and somebody there treats them, and they go no further than that. And they, you know, I'm not sure that this is the case, but, you know, if you count all the skilled myeloma professionals and look at how many people they treat, you're going to come up with maybe 10, 15, 20% of the total population. So the other 80% are probably not even hearing that there is such a thing as a clinical trial, only because that local oncologist has no has no iron in that fire. You know, there's
right.
there's nothing there for him. You know, he loses a patient if he suggests that they go to one of these better facilities that have access to clinical trials. So
yeah,
I wonder how much of that is an issue.
Yeah, I think it may be, it's hopefully becoming less of an issue. You know, the good thing is that with, you know, drugs like Velcade, Revlimid, Pomalyst, Kyprolis, you know, local, community chemoncs can really successfully manage patients. You know, 10 years ago, we would really, 15 years ago, encourage patients to get to major centers. But now, you know, they're really good drugs for the first couple of, stages of the disease and more. I mean, I have patients reaching out to me saying, hey, my doctor wants to participate in the daratumumab phase 3. Could you, you know, pass his information along to the company? So, you know, we're happy to do that as well to help facilitate some of these larger practices potentially participating in trials. So that's changing as well and bringing the trials to the community, which, you know, everyone wins because, you know, as you pointed out, few patients participate in trials. And if we can, you know, disperse trials throughout as many practices as possible, certainly the phase ones are technical and usually have to be done at a major center, but those are, you know, 20 or 40 patients. The larger phase threes can be done at a lot of these practices. So I think it's becoming less of an issue, and I think if even where it becomes an issue, a lot of the, or maybe perceived as an issue, a lot of the major centers are very collaborative and are very used to dealing with, a patient's local doctor, and they're not trying to poach any. You know, they really aren't trying to poach anyone. They will work closely with the doctor, and then the patient, you know, goes back to the doctor and the first doctor. And I think it's about having an open dialogue with your doctor. And I think that it's a difficult thing to do, but many, many doctors are receptive to it.
Thanks, Gary. Could we move on to
welcome.
Cindy here and give her a shot? And Cindy, why don't I've seen your list of questions, and you have some phenomenal. You've got a dozen of them here. Could you maybe pick top, the best of Cindy 3 questions and ask Ann?
I think I could do that. Thanks so much, Ann, for what you've told us so far. Actually, a lot of the questions I had there were answered by your introduction. But I guess one question I have is, we keep on talking about sequencing and the human genome and things like that. Can you just tell us a little bit about how that's done and what we find out once we have a sequence? Like, what is sequencing the human genome all about?
Okay, you cut out a little bit, so I think I heard the question. Talking about the mapping the human genome and why it's important, is that what?
Right, and how
okay.
you do it.
Okay, so, you know, one thing to make sure that everyone understands is that, you know, your the DNA of your normal cells differs from the DNA of your myeloma cells. So, you know, you take Kathy Giusti as an example, she has an identical twin. You know, they're identical except her myeloma cells. Karen has nothing like her myeloma cells. Those have a completely different, set of DNA. So the human genome, because there really has been limited work and limited evidence as to a strong, familial heredity, being inherited, the human genome, I think, it may become more value, but it's really the myeloma genome. So looking at your myeloma cells and understanding where there are differences between your normal cells. So what the researchers did in the genomics initiative and we're doing through Compass is patients have myeloma cells taken out of their marrow as well as, you know, regular blood so that they can compare, well, what are the differences? You know, what does this person's normal DNA look like versus, you know, what does their normal genome look like versus their myeloma genome? And that's where you can start to understand, you know, mutation, you know, the different genetic mutations that appear. And, you know, when you look at, you know, even 38, so the first 38 that we did through the genomics initiative, and I think because, Cindy, I got a list of your questions. Well, I think I may be answering, so you may get four because I'll answer one of your questions in this one. One thing that we found was a mutation in a very specific mutation in a gene called BRAF, and it had never been seen in myeloma before. It's common in melanoma, and there's a drug called vemurafenib given to melanoma patients, about 50% of them, who have this very specific mutation. And, you know, it was seen in about 4% of the samples, and interestingly, that has been consistently seen in Compass, in the larger set, the 203, and then in Compass as well. So, you know, because of the heterogeneity, certainly mutations that are more common, like P53, which is deletion of 17P, that's seen in you know, 15% or so of patients. But when you're looking at ones that are 4 or 5%, you need a lot of different samples. And even in going back to the genomics, I think there were 7 that had this other mutation that appeared in the second set, wasn't seen in the first 38. So it's important to have, and you know, what we're trying to do too is now build these collaborations because other, especially in Europe, there are other centers doing this kind of work. So we have our 1,000. Imagine pulling that together with many other centers, you know, hundreds of samples, and really making sense of this disease. Does that answer your question?
It does, and so that's where this, and I'm trying to make sense of this whole initiative too, so that's where this big data comes in, like all this information is being entered into some type of computer program? Is that what would be happening?
And quite honestly, so big data is exactly that. It's just huge amounts of any kind of data. In this instance, it's genomic data, and there's, I mean, it's like trillions of lines of, you know, sequencing down to, you know, at the deepest level that you could look at these genes, and this is all of the genes. You know, there's a difference, whole genome versus whole exome. Whole exome sequencing is those that are expressed, and that may be all that's needed. Looking at everything, may not provide value, but we want to make sure that we're looking at the full landscape before we narrow down. And even, you know, when I said the data goes into the public domain, it's not the raw data, it's analyzed at a certain level because, you know, the raw, we couldn't put all of the raw data onto the gateway that we developed, which is really kind of more for translational researchers or clinicians because it's almost like Amazon where you say, okay, I want to look at, you know, women who are over 65 who were treated first line with Velcade and have a translocation of 414, and then it'll, you know, spit back what those patients look like. But the raw files, I can tell you because we're sending them to some of the sponsors. It's literally hundreds of thousands of dollars to pull that data and just create the files to be able to transfer that data to them. And on the genomics initiative, where we had some information going through a public portal as well, the sequence data we have to put out through a different program through the government because of the sheer size of it.
Oh, wow. That's what I kind of figured. It's just so big. Mm-hmm. And when you're saying public domain, it's for everyone to look at, not just for people that are members of the MMRC?
Absolutely. So on the genomics initiative, that was those 200 that we were just talking about. That is just, there's a public portal through Broad, and you need to register just so they can see who's on there. And you know, we have, like, I want to say 1,400 or 1,500 people who have registered to look at that data. And then same with Compass. You do need to register, and you're supposed to be a nonprofit because, you know, nonprofit entity, a research, you know, an academic research institution. But, yeah, anyone can access it. There's, you know, really for both, there's a short time where the partners get access to it. And then after that, you know, it all, but nothing can be patented during that time. It's just, you know, to, you know, put together a publication, for example. But if your publication is not done in time, forget it. The data's out there in the public domain, and you've lost your opportunity.
Now, the community gateways for the myeloma population, myeloma patients can communicate with each other through that community gateway, and we'll be able to search other patients like you. I'm thinking from what you said that maybe researchers or nurse clinicians will start searching that data and then reaching out to some patients who they might think are good for clinical trials. Is that what I'm hearing
you
say? Yes,
that could happen. Or, you know, even, you know, it's self-reported data, so it's a little bit different, although, you know, part of our vision is to be for those, you know, patients who have access to their electronic medical record. And you know, for example, are seen at centers where, you know, you log onto a portal and you have everything. You know, our vision is, in the not-too-distant future, be able to, you know, dump that into the community gateway as well. And so, you know, researchers or nurses could also come up with hypotheses because, you know, there could be, you know, side effects that you know, for whatever reason, have been underreported or, you know, not seen in the same way that they are when patients are self-reporting them in this kind of situation. So there may be that kind of analysis done, and who knows, there could even be hypotheses for trials coming out of the community gateway as well.
That's pretty exciting. Will there be some, like, updates on that community gateway? Because I know I've been trying to enter some data, and I'm just kind of fighting with the system sometimes because I guess that when I was trying to enter some of my numbers, since I don't get my IgA or IgM tested, they would not let me enter some things in. Are there going to be, like, updates to make it a little bit more user-friendly?
Yes, and you have been, I mean, I just, there have been a few people who have been tremendously helpful, and you've been one of them, and I know that Jenny has really appreciated your feedback. What we're, you know, our goal is to have, you know, an optimized site by the end of the first quarter. You know, right now we don't have, you know, patients don't even have the ability to enter all the, like, longitudinal data. So the goal is for that to be fixed in the, you know, March, April timeframe. But certainly I encourage anyone and everyone who's listening, if you have feedback, whether it's what you think is a tiny glitch or something that you think is glaringly, you know, missing or not right on the gateway, please, please, please reach out to us because we just launched, you know, 4 months ago. This is a work in progress. And while we're trying to have a site that is kind of the 1.0 complete by the end of March, you know, we are evolving to, you know, again, you know, being able, you know, allowing patients to bring in, you know, clinical data and test results and all of that, and be able to, you know, conduct surveys and perhaps analyses of some of the self-reported data. So, and we want, you know, you all, everyone to be engaged as well, finding, you know, if you have, you know, something unusual about your myeloma and have never really found someone who had that experience, we want to enable that here so that you, you know, you have a sounding board, you have someone to connect to and share information.
Okay.
Ladies,
so
I know that Matt has a couple questions about the Community Gateway, and I want to get him in here while he still has questions to ask, because so many things get covered when, by the time you're the last questioner. Matt, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Thanks, Pat.
Sure, sure. Hey, you've got the floor as long as you want, buddy.
Okay. Thanks. And thanks for doing this, and Pat, thanks for setting it up. This is, I think this could probably be about a four-hour talk, and we still have things to ask. I'm going to go, I was just thinking as I was listening, and I'm going to go off my list of questions.
Sure.
And ask something else about what the MMRF does. You know, you mentioned Kathy and her twin sister, and I'm wondering, do you, it'll be sort of a two-parter, do you guys look at some of the factors that lead to that sort of switch in a person's body that myeloma kicks in? Do you look at environmental factors? And in terms of the genomics, do you see what the genomics is serving as more as a helping with treatment or something more preventative or a little of both?
So just to clarify your second question, I'm not sure I quite followed. The genomics, if it's, can it be prevented or it helps guide treatment?
Is the data that's coming out of the genomics and, you know, you're taking all these different researchers and institutions, is the data being used more towards coming up with more effective treatments, or is it also, can it be also used to try and figure out how to actually prevent people from getting myeloma?
Okay. So I'll tackle the first question. We haven't really done, we haven't directly done work in terms of, you know, hereditary look. I know there are some researchers, I think it was Creighton, his name is escaping me, at Creighton University. I think Leif Bergsiegel at Mayo Scottsdale has done some too. We are asking as part of COMPASS, do you have, you know, with any cancer, you know, do you have a first-degree relative with any cancer? And certainly myeloma is one of those. I don't think in the first, the last interim analysis, which is a couple hundred patients, we hadn't seen anyone with first-degree relatives. Interestingly, Kathy Juicy's grandfather had multiple myeloma. So, you know, it's more, I think, epidemiological at this point. I don't think that there's been anything seen comparing, you know, the normal DNA of Kathy and Karen versus the myeloma, anything that seems apparent. But, you know, perhaps through what we and others are doing, there may be hereditary factors that appear. And then, you know, related on your second question, you know, the prevention piece also goes back to a hereditary factor. So that would be something that would appear in your, you know, normal genome. However, you know, prevent or delaying, I guess, if we can identify, MGUS or smoldering patients, and this is the entire community effort, patients who are more likely to convert to active myeloma, now that some of these antibodies are emerging and the antibodies have, you know, especially these anti-CD38 antibodies, they're effective and don't have the same level of toxicity that some of the older treatments do, it may make sense to treat patients earlier and prevent that progression, especially for those patients who can be identified at high risk. But it's early, you know, I think all of this is early days, and who knows, maybe once we have a critical mass of not just our own, but, you know, worldwide data sets, we might, you know, there might be genes identified that lead to hereditary myeloma.
Mm-hmm. And with the Community Gateway, to be honest, I signed up or I got myself in the system initially when I first heard about it, and then it was sort of out of sight, out of mind, and I never really thought about it again until actually this call was set up. is there a way that you guys are looking at sort of promoting it a little bit more, or make, I mean, because it seems like it serves a great purpose.
Yeah, it's I know Cindy has had, you know, based on conversations with Jenny, who's a, you know, our project manager on the project, has had some great ideas. You know, we've been hesitant to do too much marketing until the site's optimized, because there are, one, there are still some bugs. Then two, it's just not where we want it. You know, we don't have everything up and running. We wanted to launch it last year and, you know, get some folks on there and having experiences. But until we've been a little bit quiet about it, until we have everything where we want it to be for the end of phase one. And then, you know, at that point, and if I know that Jenny's will be looking for kind of a team of advisors, you know, a small team of advisors in terms of not, you know, what's on the site, but the marketing aspects of it and trying to understand how much outreach is appropriate, you know, is getting a daily, you know, before we launched this in benchmarking, I signed up for this diabetes site, and literally I get an email every single day. Is that overkill? Do you do, you know, weekly? Is it, you know, are there certain triggers to allow people to sign up for how frequently they want to be notified about updates? So all of that needs to be developed, and certainly if you have, you know, ideas or would like to become more of a, you know, and again, kind of an advisor to this, we'd be happy to hear that or have you.
Sure. Okay, thanks. One more question, if that's okay. Going back to you're sort of taking data from different investigators and research centers across the country and kind of putting it all together. Could you just sort of give a little overview and kind of on how you do that? How do you take different data or different centers that might have different approaches or even different theories? How do you put it all together and come up with something where you sort of have a little more cohesiveness?
So, well, COMPASS is a protocol. It's not an interventional study. So, you know, patients who enroll in COMPASS, all they need, they have to require treatment, and then it can be with a proteasome inhibitor and or an IMID. So it's not, you know, like a clinical trial where you're assigned to an arm or an investigational treatment. But there is then, you know, a protocol that the doctors have to follow. So every, you know, they fill out the same, they have the same informed consent, then they fill out the same case report form for patients and you know, enter the data, you know, submit the data that way. You know, when it comes to having others, you know, add their data to the researcher gateway, I can tell you for the first portal that we developed for the Genomics Initiative, there are data on there from Arkansas, from Millennium, from Mayo, from Dana-Farber. You know, they waited until they'd published. You know, fair enough, that's how you advance in your career in academia, but at least they were still willing to put the data in there. And we've had discussions not just with, you know, U.S.-based companies or researchers, but excitingly, a lot of, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of this work is going on in Europe as well, and they're very kind of excited to, you know, join this effort and add their data so that, you know, I think the details will be about, you know, matching fields and whatnot, but it's been done to a smaller extent before, so I think we're hopeful that we can do it through the Researcher Gateway as well.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks, Matt. Anne, that's great.
Sure.
Let's rotate back. Mr. Gary Peterson, follow-up?
Lizzie's, isn't she on?
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. Sure. Apparently, Lizzie was detained. Something came up. So, and her questions, I have several of her questions have been covered, so we're good to go. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to throw you off there.
No, I just
anything else you'd like to add?
Yeah, sure, definitely. And Anne, thank you so much for all your time, all your efforts, and all your energy, and all of the folks at the MMRF. One of the things that I saw on ASH, and I was a little disappointed, and maybe it's because I just didn't see it, but I didn't see that there was any clinical trials yet or any focus on putting together, you know, the new good therapy, which is Revlimid, Velcade Dex, you know, which is kind of the current standard of care for high risk and for a lot of people, and including either daratumumab or Array 520. And the reason I ask that is because I noticed that there was an in vitro analysis not too long ago that showed that that combination of Revlimid, Velcade Dex, and daratumumab was significantly head and shoulders the above just RVD in effectiveness, and I was thinking, you know, given that, you know, wouldn't that be something that there'd be more focus on, either an RVDD or a RVDA for Array 520? But so, is there plans for trials in the near future for this combination? Just one more thing. Like you said before, it looks as though, you know, you give it one drug and it knocks a chunk, and then there's another chunk that's resistant to that, and you give it another drug and it knocks that chunk. And it sounds like, you know, these four knock out a lot of chunks, and maybe that would be one that might be our home run.
A couple of things, you know, the both Array 520, or now it has a name which is actually probably even more difficult to pronounce, selanesib, and daratumumab are both, you know, still in phase two, so it's still early days. I know on the daratumumab that the phase threes are planned and likely to launch in the early part of this year, or this year, but hopefully the first half. And I'm not sure if Array 520 is quite there yet. There's a couple of challenges. You know, one, you know, if it's possible to give less, you know, fewer drugs than more and get the same kind of impact, then you spare the toxicities and then cost. You know, I think that's one thing where, you know, we really haven't, you know, spoken to the companies directly, but when you're looking at an RVDA or an RVDD, that's three name brand drugs. So I think, you know, first and foremost, from a efficacy toxicity, if you can get away with just having a DARA with one of those and having something, you know, have quite a high response rate, and you know, the phase threes are looking at, you know, the differences between an IMID and a proteasome inhibitor versus having all four. You know, I think start there, and before you would jump to a phase three, you would do, you know, a phase one, and I'm sure many investigators have this idea, you know, to start with a phase one, perhaps, as you said, in a high risk, you know, like a deletion 17p population, if you can get, you know, high durable responses, because the issue there is not so much the response rate, but the durability, then perhaps you do move into bigger trials. But, you know, I think if we can get away with, you know, less is often more, and then maybe, you know, figure out the right sequence, because the other challenge could be if you use too much, you know, do you lose those options down the road when you may have another clone emerging that could be sensitive to one of those treatments. So there's a lot to be figured out, but I'm guessing you'll at least see some kind of pilot study with that combination down the road.
They did put together the combination of Revlimid, dexamethasone, and daratumumab, and the initial results were stellar. And
yeah,
in the in vitro study, the four drug combination was even better than that. At least that was my understanding.
Yeah, you just don't. I mean, with that, you don't see what toxicities, what the toxicities would look like. But no, I mean, absolutely. I think, we'll have to figure out. Can you, maybe it is worth, a four drug combination if you give.
You're talking to somebody who was on, who went to UAMS with a few other folks,
yeah.
And so when you talk about four drugs, we're the ones that had like six drug combinations. So.
Sure,
you laughed at four drugs.
Yeah, I laugh. You show me your four drugs, and I'll raise you six.
Ann and Gary, before Priya cuts us off, because we've got to be about at the end of our time, I wanted to suggest, see what everybody thought. Ann, if you would be willing to come back sometime in the near future, I think I would like to try to focus some of this and maybe have one, two, or even three shows on specific types of things that the MMRF is doing. There's just so much to process, and maybe if we focus a little bit, for example, maybe when the gateway, when you're ready to announce the gateway, Ann, maybe you'd come back and help us help patients work with that a little bit.
No, absolutely, and we're a small team, but others of my colleagues can come on as well. If say there was a topic on immune therapy. One of my, either Joan or Daniel, I mean, they're tremendously, passionate about that area. And same with, precision medicine and precision trials, our vision is, to be able to, have these trials. We have different arms of different patient profiles and, I think having, one or both of them on those topics could be phenomenal as well. They're scientists, but they love talk. They love talking with patients, and I think can talk at an appropriate level.
Well, I've met them. They're wonderful. Very, very enthusiastic and committed to what they do. Also, we'll coordinate things and try to come up with some topics. That's a great idea. And the Community Gateway, I'm glad you said that you're not really pushing it yet, because I was. At one point, I got a couple notices saying, hey, you've got 14 people that want to, it's not be your friend, what do you call it?
Connect.
And I don't think I've heard anything for 3 weeks. So either I'm suddenly friendless or I just figured you guys were working on stuff.
Yeah, no, it's still there. I actually, I have to admit, too, I got a notice the other day about one. So you go, if you need help, if you forgot your username, password, anything, but you should go in there because they're still pending.
Sounds good. Priya, are we set?
Yes, thank you so much, Pat. Anne, it was great having you here, and yes, I will get in touch with you, and be a wonderful opportunity to have you and your colleagues back on our show again, and we can actually plan out a couple of shows and topics, and I will be in touch with you regarding that. Thank you so much for being with us today. Pat, Gary, Cindy, and Matt, I think your contribution is irreplaceable. Thank you so very much. And to the audience, we have quite a few people dialed in today. Please make sure you mark your calendars for the 26th of Feb. We are having Dr. Vincent Rajkumar of Mayo Clinic with us. It's at 5 p.m. and earlier than our usual show. And we're going to discuss myeloma cure versus control. You can always access my MMRF trial search tool for myeloma trials at myeloma.trialx.com/ask. For more details of upcoming shows, please visit curepanel.carefeet.net. And you can always mail me, priya@trialx.com, regarding anything with CurePanel Talk Show. The link to today's show will be shared via email to all participants. Thank you very much. I think it was a wonderful show today.
Thanks, everybody. And Ann, I don't know how you keep it all straight. You're amazing.
Oh, no, thank you. It honestly has been such a pleasure. Like I said before, I could go on for two more hours. So thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Sounds like we're going to take you up on that. Thank you. Thanks, everybody.
Okay. Thanks. Good night.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Good night.